Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. The brightest of bargains await in the unmissable Black Friday event, in-store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551. On the one hand, thankfully, as a country, we have not had many air disasters. Of course, we had the Tusker air disaster, and that saw over 100 people killed off Tusker Rock. And after that, there was, I'm remembering the Dauphin, the brilliant airmen from the Irish Air Corps. Four of them were killed in Tremor in 1999 when the Dauphin helicopter crashed in fog. There was a long time before that, there was an incident in Shannon. And then the other air disaster that Irish people remember is Staines. It's the place in England. And there was a lot of Irish business people on board that particular crash. And that was in 1972, and there was 118 people, some of them Irish. But 40 years ago, and this came up yesterday on the programme tangentially, because we mentioned Fred Teat. One of our callers mentioned Fred Teat, 1956, saw him boxing, and Ronnie Delaney. He won a silver, Ronnie Delaney won gold in Melbourne. And I said, I remember the day I met Fred Teat. And the day I met Fred Teat is November 1984, November 13th. And the reason is that it was Fred Teat who told me about this air disaster, which was just unfolding in England. 9 people had left Dublin Airport in a private charter plane the previous evening, and the plane had disappeared. And it was presumed at that stage that the 9 people had all been killed. So there are ranks, unfortunately, up there among the greatest Irish air disasters. The 9 people were Niall Hanley, editor of the Evening Herald, John Feeney, incredibly well-known firebrand of his day, Late Late Show, wrote books about John Charles McQuaid, wrote newspaper columns. Tony Heenan, again, a fine journalist with the Independent Group. Kevin Maron, a lot of people remember Kevin Maron of the Sunday World, a genius, a comic genius, as well as a fantastic talent. Kevin was on the plane that crashed, and Kevin even had a song written about him by Clifford T. Ward called Maron's Glance. But Kevin was a legendary journalist of his time, like the other 3. And then the other people that were killed were Cormac Cassidy of Cassidy Wines, Pat Gibbons, a lot of people knew Pat Sands Hotel in Portmarnock, Francis Shebaugh, who was the manager of one of Pat Gibbons' restaurants, Adigi Jiki, who was a sommelier, and then the pilot was a man called John Walsh, and all 9 of them were killed this month, 40 years ago, in England. Now, Peter Feeney, formerly of this parish and also media press ombudsman, was Peter. Peter is a brother of the late John Feeney. Peter, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Well, what again surprised me yesterday is that the number of people who were unaware of this disaster. And it was such a major story. 9 people killed. Do you remember it unfolding that evening and the following morning?
I do, of course, Joe. And I mean, the main tragedy, too, is that there were 9 wives or partners left behind, and 25 children lost their fathers in that crash. So, of course, it was an awful evening. I was in RTE that night editing a documentary, and I was coming down the stairs between 8 and 9 in the evening, and Murish McNeil, who was controller of programmes, came up the stairs to me and said, "Peter, there's some very bad news. There's been a plane crash, and we think your brother John was on the plane."
Oh, my God.
So I rushed home, and then I drove down to Curtistown in County Wicklow, where my brother John and his wife Aoife lived, to be with her. And it was so tragic because all the children were asleep in the house, and we knew that when they woke up in the morning, they were going to be told their father was dead. So it was a very, very tragic night. And then to compound it, when I was in her house at midnight, I got a phone call from my home saying my wife had gone into labour and been rushed to the Coombe Hospital.
Okay.
So could I come back as quickly as possible? So I went from John's widow's house back up to Coombe Hospital for my little baby son Niall was born a couple of hours later.
And John, was it like the others? He was relatively young.
He was. Most of them were in their 40s,
30s
and 40s. And what's so sad about it in a way is it was such a sort of a meaningless flight. They were going over to get the first bottle of Beaujolais Nouveau. Yeah. It was a PR exercise which had been going on for a number of years. It boosted the sales of Beaujolais Nouveau wine. And these guys went out on what should have been a rather jolly Skype to bring back a couple of bottles of wine and drink them the first Beaujolais Nouveau in Ireland of the year. And of course, the plane crashed and all nine of them died.
And as you say, 25 children, because the they were all men, they were all relatively, as I say, relatively young. When did it emerge that the plane had actually crashed and had been found in a remote part of England?
Well, it would appear that the plane took off from Dublin heading towards Paris. It crossed over the south of England, over Brighton, the south coast, and was heading towards Paris. And then it did a U-turn and was returning back towards England. Okay. And it was last seen over Eastbourne in south England. And people who saw the plane said they thought the engine seemed to be stalling. Okay. And then the plane crashed in a very beautiful part of the countryside in East Sussex called Jeffington. It's a beautiful spot. And the plane crashed there. And the assumption is the pilot was trying to find somewhere to land the plane. Something had gone catastrophically wrong.
This is a news report again from the legendary Charlie Bird, on the morning afterwards.
The grim task for accident investigators of searching through the wreckage began here at first light this morning. The operation has been made even more difficult by the fact that the wreckage was spread over a wide area. The main fuselage was found here, yet one of the engines was found 2 miles away close to the village of Jeffington.
In fact, one of our officers located it fairly quickly. A traffic patrolman went along the road through Jeffington and saw, in fact, what turned out to be the fuselage on the hillside, and obviously was able to direct the other emergency services, the fire service and the ambulance service and other police officers to the scene more or less straight away.
Now, the wreckage of the plane is spread over a very wide area. Why is that? Do you know any reason for that?
Well, it would be quite wrong of me to speculate on what caused the aircraft to crash, and I'm not an expert in aircraft matters, so I must say that until the examiners, the official aircraft examiners, have finished their work, I couldn't begin to answer that effectively. What I can confirm is that parts of the aircraft were found some way from the main fuselage. That is true.
And that was Charlie Bird talking to police inspector there near Jeddington. Liam Collins was a young journalist at the time. And Liam, and you're currently with the Sunday Indo and many other publications in a long illustrious career. Liam, what are your memories of the time? Your memories?
Oh, look, it was a horrific time for all of us. I worked in the Evening Herald at the time, so Niall Handley was my boss, and I knew John Feeney very well because I often stepped in for him, and Tony Hennigan as well, and Kevin Marin was a family friend from years back. So my memory of it is I was actually out that night somewhere, and I remember going down Prince's Street at about 7 in the morning and meeting James Morrissey, and he said, you know what happened, and I hadn't a clue. And it was a shocking thing to hear that they were just all gone. And as Peter said, it was a jolly, you know, Dublin was full of kind of receptions and things like that at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was meant to be a bit of fun to go over, collect a few bottles and bring the first ones back into Ireland. So all we did for a week after was try and get the papers out and cover the funerals of the various people, nine people who were killed.
It's shocking, but Liam, try and give people, and you touched on it there because you're prodding my memory. At that time in the 80s, especially, there was a social scene in Dublin. Each evening newspaper, the Evening Press, the great legendary Evening Press, and the Evening Herald, both of them had social pages, and they would be based on. I know Nuala Fualan's father was one of the Terry O'Sullivan. Well done, Liam.
Yeah.
Terry O'Sullivan.
Yeah.
And they would go round all the Gresham and the Wynns, so all the events seemed to take place at 6, 7 o'clock. There'd be launches.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
this.
And it was every night. There might have been 10 or 12 events. I mean, you could pick and choose. And we used to go around. I used to fill in, as I said, for John Feeney. So, and you'd meet politicians, you'd meet PR people, you'd meet famous actors, and you know, all were in this circuit. And it, there was great stories because everybody wanted to get into the page.
Yeah.
I mean, Terry O'Sullivan in the Evening Press was kind of like a god. Somebody would be waiting at the door with a glass of whatever particular wine we drank, and it wasn't Beaujolais Nouveau, I can tell you. It was good Bordeaux.
Okay.
The legend was that unless someone was there with his glass of wine, he wouldn't come in, you know. But it was a very... people loved it. You just mentioned lots of names of people who were attending these events. And I suppose for most people, it was their only kind of... It was their brush with fame. But then there was... all these people who were going on, who were on the circuit, and you got to know them very well. In fact, I took over for 6 months with John Feeney's death because I had, as I say, been a stand-in for him. So more or less, it had to be, you know, it had to, after a day or two, we had to get back to normal business. That's just tough.
I remember
media life.
I remember the headline at the Herald the next day, Our Darkest Day.
Yes,
because
that's
of the number of people from the Herald that were killed in the crash.
Yeah,
Our Darkest Day. But that paper, day in, day out, had to be put out by colleagues of the people who were killed.
That's right, yeah. And there isn't much sentiment, as you know, in newspaper offices. But at the same time, it was a shocking thing. And it took a lot of people a long time to recover. But as you say, the families and those children, I never actually computed that. The amount of children, I do know Barry Handley and Helen, his sister. And, you know, it was a terrible thing for them to lose their father at such a young age.
I want to talk about Kevin Barron in a second and the other people, but Liam, I don't want to ask Peter because he's his brother, but remind people of the fame of John Feeney, who was killed. Late Late Show, John Charles McQuaid. He was way ahead of his time.
He was. Well, John was what you could say call a maverick. He broke the mold kind of that newspaper column, you know, where it was kind of genteel up till his arrival, and then he caused a bit of chaos. He got some fantastic stories. He got one or two fantastically wrong, as people would point out probably. But, you know, he was turning it out a page every night and at the same time doing that circuit. So it was he was great company to be with. Yeah. You know, you could, anywhere you went, John was just full of life. He really had a zest for life and journalism and causing trouble to a certain extent.
Yeah, I'm thinking back just for people today. I can see John Feeney on the Late Late Show. He was on the panel.
Long hair and a beard and he took an interest in church things and politics, and but he was larger than life.
He sure was,
And
again, I'm thinking of people like Vincent, thank God, is still with us. But he was in the mould of Vincent Brown, a real brave journalist, not afraid to speak.
Yeah.
There was a whole slew of you there at the time. That's why it became such a shock.
Just the last thing. There was fierce rivalry. It's hard to believe fierce rivalry between the Press and the Independent, you know, the Press and the Herald.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, they were always trying to get one-upmanship between.
Yeah.
But although we were great friends with some of them, but it was just that era, you know, there was no mobile phones, there was no, you know, communications like there is today. So somebody had to go out every evening with a photographer, and the evening press actually had a Mercedes and a chauffeur to bring their
Fly around the town,
and later the great Joe Kennedy took over when Terry passed on or retired. So I think it was a hugely influential page in the paper, yeah, and people loved it.
In many ways, it was a those pages which some of those people worked on were a precursor of, say, Hello magazine, or all the stuff you see today, which is seems to be the main diet of people, celebrity news.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's why the Herald and the Press were among the biggest selling newspapers in the country at the time. Peter Grogan, 0818 715 815. We're remembering. It's called the Beaujolais air disaster, and Liam explained why. We'll go into more detail later. And it happened this month, 1984, and it ranks, unfortunately, as one of the greatest air disasters from an aircraft that left Ireland, and it was 9 people killed. Peter Grogan, Peter, you want to talk about the connection between Kevin Maron, who was one of the founding editors of the Sunday World and a brilliant journalist, a trailblazing journalist, and Clifford T. Ward, the late Clifford T. Ward. What was the connection?
The connection, I think it was Larry Gogan originally. I wrote to Larry.
Okay.
Saying I was starting off a Clifford T. Ward fan club here in Dublin, here in Ireland.
Okay.
And through that, I was giving some copies of songs to the likes of Mike Murphy, to the likes of Larry. And they were all very, very loyal to him. Obviously, Kevin Maron stood out as well. He picked up on it.
Yeah.
And he listened to Clifford T, and he was absolutely smitten by the man's writing.
Right.
His style of writing, compassion and his empathy. And Mike Murphy contacted me. It was Kevin Maron's birthday was coming up. He said, would by any chance Clifford T put pen to paper?
Wow.
And he wrote, as you said there a moment ago, Maron's Glance.
Yeah.
And one of the lines that stands out to me, I think it was a line from O'Casey that he said, and the moving finger writes. And Clifford T turned it around to Kevin Maron, and the moving finger bites.
Yeah.
And seemingly, there was a tear in the eye of Kevin Maron. It even reduced him to a tear, Mike Murphy said. But we have fond memories. When I broke the news to Clifford T about the disaster,
mm-hmm.
he said he was just absolutely dumbstruck. And it wasn't like Clifford T. He was always wound up about the music industry and Maggie Thatcher at the time. But I said, are you still there, Cliff? Are you still there? And he insisted on coming over. I drove him to Dundalk.
To the funeral,
to the mass in Dundalk. And he was, we'd stand here, they were there at the graveside. And Clifford T couldn't stand there. He actually walked away. And he walked about 50, 60 yards away. This is the only way I can cope with this theatre, is to just send my wishes to his family. But he could not stand at the graveside. He was so affected by it.
And the song, the lyrics of the song are, again, I'm trying to embrace people who didn't even remember this awful disaster. But again, to point out how Kevin Maron, he used to write the television listings, and he started this incredible trend, which it still exists in some. The television listings, okay, you'd have 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, five, but under each programme, Kevin wouldn't write about the programme. He'd begin writing an essay which would continue down through every programme and would have some reference to the programme. It was just pure genius. Garrett Scanlon, stay with us, Peter. 51551
no problem.
Text. Garrett Scanlon's in Kilcock. What do you remember, Garrett?
Joe, hi. Yeah. I was working with my dad, John Scanlon. He managed Lord John's nightclub down in Sackville Place. And John Ryan, and that was a very good friend of Pat Gibbons. You know, Pat Gibbons, actually, he owned the Chicago nightclub in Baggot Street.
And
everybody would know that.
And Sands Hotel out in Portmore.
He was a co-owner of Sands Hotel with John Ryan. And John Ryan owned Lord John's. And my dad was a very good friend of all those guys. You know, he worked with them for years. And he managed Barry's Hotel and all that type of stuff. So he would be very familiar with all those people. And we were working on that night in Lord John's,
mm-hmm.
in Sackville Place, when we heard about the crash and all that type of stuff. So, yeah, it was different times.
Cormac Cassidy of Cassidy Wines, they're still going, obviously, great company. Francis Chabon, who was the manager, one of Pat Gibbons' manager, he was killed. Adagi Chichi, who was involved in wine as well, and then John Walsh was the pilot. They were the 9 people that were killed. It was such an awful disaster. Gareth, I don't know whether Liam alluded to it there. I don't know how to. Well, maybe I'll go back to Peter Feeney. Peter, you said earlier it was such a pointless, meaningless trip. Now
yes.
It could happen. It could happen anywhere with any of us.
Yeah, but I mean, in a way, you know, the sort of the world of publicity and entertainment and gathering attention often is quite meaningless. We all know events are staged for their sort of the publicity aspect of it. This was just one of those. There's nothing particularly unique about it. It had been going on for a number of years. It kind of died out afterwards.
It sure did,
you know, lots of events are like that. They've no great significance in themselves.
But because the Beaujolais wine comes out every year, the 2024 launch of Beaujolais, it's the first wine of the year of that vintage that's actually sold. It comes out, and I think it's the second Thursday or whatever. There's a special day in November. And Liam, do you remember where this nonsense began of this race?
No, I don't, but it had been going on for three or four years. And as Peter said, like a lot of these events were kind of staged because it was a great coup to get in the paper and, you know, to get this kind of coverage. And of course, John Feeney and I suppose the editor, they joined in the excitement because it's showed you were on the ball, you know, that everything that was being covered and all these new events, you know, but it had been going on. And I think there were other people later who said they were invited and they couldn't go for some reason or another. And there, but for the grace of God, you know.
But it became known, I think, as the Beaujolais race.
Yes, and it did, because it was to get the wine back first. And I mean, I did try Beaujolais before that, but I never drank it since. And it was pretty. It wasn't a very nice wine at the time, even. But it was the excitement. The idea of a race.
Yeah, but I'll try and draw on Liam. You can help as well. I'm trying to draw on Peter Feeney's greater knowledge on this. But Peter, wasn't there a phenomenon in the last century of a race to get the first bottle of wine to Ireland, to get the first letter, if there was, to get the first journey across? A lot of things turned into races.
But in a sense, it was as a joke rather than anything else. Because, you know, it's just a bottle of wine. But you can see how, in a time where less people travelled and in which people were confined, that there was sort of a notion of excitement.
That's a very good point,
I mean, you've got to sort of draw a parallel with sort of social media today. I suppose the columnists in the Herald and Press were the equivalent to Facebook or TikTok today. Yeah, and that is, they sort of provided entertainment for people and something to lift them a bit. So it was in that vein, I think.
Yeah. And Peter, did we ever find out what happened?
Well, there's really three explanations for any plane crash. One is weather, one is pilot error, and the third is something wrong with the aircraft.
Okay.
The weather was bad that night, but it wasn't catastrophically bad.
Okay.
There's no evidence whatsoever of any pilot error. The pilot was hugely experienced. He had 11,000 hours of flying experience. So the most likely explanation is a fault with the aircraft. And speculation has been that the autopilot may have given trouble or part of the aircraft broke off. And the particular make of aircraft, it emerged, had a reputation for problems. There had been 17 previous crashes of that particular aircraft. It was called a Rockwell Commander or Aero Commander. It was an American aircraft, a two-engine propeller aircraft. Yeah. And it emerged that there had been issues with that aircraft before. But it was a very widely used aircraft, used by military as well as by civilians. And in the heel of the hunt, the insurance companies, I think, more or less accepted that something wrong with the aircraft was the explanation for it.
Okay.
But I think there was never any definitive argument about how it happened. The plane, as I said earlier, was seen flying over the south coast of England looking for somewhere to land. So clearly the pilot knew that there had been there was something wrong with the aircraft and that he needed to find somewhere to land. It was dark, of course, at the time. And it looks like the plane may have exploded in the air above the ground, because I would explain why it was found spread over 2 miles.
And was there inquest? Was there?
Yes, there were. Of course, there were. And what can be said? All 9 people died. It looks like some of them died in the air, that they didn't die when they hit the ground. They were actually exposed in the air. So, tragically, their bodies are found spread over a distance as well.
Yeah. Okay, I'll ask. Thanks, Peter Feeney. Thanks, Liam Collins and Gareth Scanlon. Peter Grogan, I'm going to ask you to introduce Marin's Glance by the legendary, the late Clifford T. Ward. But we obviously remember Niall Hanley, John Feeney, Tony Heenahan, Kevin Marin, who we're talking about there, Cormac Cassidy, Pat Gibbons, Francis Chibon, Adigi Shishi, and John Walsh, the poet. Will you introduce this song and remind us why Clifford T. Ward, one of the greatest songwriters ever in these islands and beyond, chose to write a song about Kevin Marin, one of the people that was subsequently killed. And there's some incredible lines. Go ahead, Peter, and we'll start the song.
Thanks very much, Joe. And one of my regrets is not introducing you to him when he was in the full of his health. It is a wonderful song. He turned it over in one day.
Right.
One day. I told him this was the reason. He turned it over. He sent it over by mail, would you believe? It arrived at my doorstep. I brought it to RTE. It was the warmth of Kevin Marin that really, really got to Clifford T. He had this sort of an image of being this hard-nosed critic with his cream suit. He was anything but. And any time that Clifford T came to Ireland, we gathered in Kevin's house with his lovely wife, Margaret, or in Val Joyce's house with the likes of Val and Vera Joyce and Father Brian Darcy.
Of course, yeah.
Lovely, lovely people. And it was that warmth that Clifford T found here and got here in Ireland, and support that he really didn't get at the time in England. Proof of that being was I got John Woods and Polygram to issue the Both of Us album here. Where
I remember
he was
that. I couldn't get
England.
Yeah. Okay, just listen carefully to the lyrics, the wonderful lyrics of Clifford T. Ward.
Absolutely
about,
gorgeous.
About Kevin Marin. For us dreamers, all do practice, we only get one chance. And God help those who stumble in front of Marin's glance. We are triers, if not believers, and we will have our day. And of some it may come quickly, and for others go the same way. We are lost, we are confounded, we some of us in despair. It's an old recording. It's nearly 40 years, but the last two lines are, we still love him just the same because he was a critic. But the devil take you, Marin, when your pen grows tired and tame.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. The brightest of bargains await in the unmissable Black Friday event, in-store or online at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
See all the legendary names from journalism of that time, the 80s, when the Beaujolais race, as Peter and Liam explained, it was a nonsense at the time, but it was a need for a nonsense. It was a dark time in the country. Anne, good afternoon. Anne, your
hello,
husband,
Joe.
the legendary Tom McElroy.
Oh, stop it.
The Sunday World.
It just evokes an awful lot of sad memories, Joe, listening
course.
There. My brother, 22-year-old, was killed that year, tragically. Oh. And then Kevin, who was our best man at our wedding, and Tom, of course, worked with him. They were very close.
And Kevin was larger than life, wasn't he?
He was larger than life. And he was very dry,
yes,
very funny, but very unassuming type of a chap. And so I just was thinking back. But Tom was away at the time.
Ah.
And I got a phone call to say there's been a plane crash. And I thought it was him.
Oh, my God.
And I said, oh, my God, I said. And I remember my daughter running down the stairs. It's only a little one, and I was, is it dad? And it wasn't, thank God. But anyway, it was just a terrible, sad time because my brother had only been killed in July, and of course, I can believe it's 40 years, but I didn't realise it was this week.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to make a little comment to say
40
that
years,
very, and if Margaret, his wife, is listening, or anybody, you know, we often think about him and talk about him.
Of course.
And,
the rest of the... You heard Clifford T. Ward sing about him.
Yes, and I remember the first time he wrote about him in his column. And he would nearly put him on the map, put Clifford T. Ward on the map.
Well,
as
Peter,
less,
well, Peter Grogan was a great, he was just been on, the great champion of Clifford T. Ward. But Peter, by introducing Clifford T. Ward to so many people here in Ireland, including myself, Clifford became bigger initially in Ireland than he did in the UK, but he's massive in the UK as well.
He died, didn't he? Yeah, he
yeah, did. Yeah, he did, yeah. MS, yeah.
Oh, that, okay. Yeah, anyway, Joe, it was just to, as I say, it brought back a lot of memories, a bit of a shock just hearing all the names and everything like that. You know what
God,
I mean?
God rest, right. God rest the nine of them. Their anniversaries around this time. Thanks indeed, Anne.
Absolutely.
Where is Dominic? Dominic Leach. Dominic, good afternoon.
How are you keeping, Joe? How are
good.
Things?
Your memories of this time 40 years ago.
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's 40 years, but I always kind of remember it when I read about it. Tony Heenan was in town and he called in. I was working in Norwich House, the tax office there. And God help us, most people didn't want to come near us in those days. But he called in the morning and he was obviously starting out something to do with his tax.
All right.
And he was enthusing about this trip he was going on. He was naming all the people that were going. And I can't remember off the top of my head, it's 40 years ago, who he said wasn't going. But he listed them all off and he said how they were going to regret not going. And and it was unusual for a guy to come in talking, you know, at the counter about where he was going and what he was doing, you know. So it was just when I was listening to you there, it just brought it home to me.
And Peter,
I always kind of think he was a nice guy, you know, really nice guy to talk to. You know, I'd never met him before. You know.
But Peter Feeney, and indeed Liam, put it in the context. It was a dull enough time, and any in the country, and any attempt at any old nonsense and a bit of colour, even a flight, even to hire a private plane for nine people, was unusual in itself. And it's hard. I know it's hard for young people now to say, are you telling me every year in Ireland around November for about 5 or 6 years until this disaster, and that was the end of it. There used to be a Beaujolais race to bring back the first bottle of wine.
Well, I'd never heard of it until Tony came in and he said it to me that he was going over for wine. And I was kind of sitting there going, what are you getting on a plane to get wine for? But it really cussed the heart out of a lot of journalistic expertise, because they were all legends in their own right, you know, those journalists.
Yeah, of course they were. And then the other people involved were household names. Pat Gibbons was a very, very well known Cormac Cass. They were well known names as well.
Okay. I seem to remember Marin's Diary in the Sunday World.
They were very funny, very funny. Thanks indeed, Dominic. Joe at RT.ie. Cathy Gibbons. Cathy, good afternoon. Obviously, your name, your surname resonates, Cathy.
Hi, Joe.
Good, thanks. You're related to Pat Gibbons through marriage, is it?
That's right, yeah. I'd be his daughter-in-law. She was alive today. Yeah, I married his son.
Okay. And what age was Pat Gibbons' son when his father was killed in the plane crash?
He would have been 3.
Wow. 3 years of age?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And a very much wanted child at the time as well. He only had 3 years with his dad before that happened.
And the effect, I can't even glimpse, the effect on the family, Cathy.
Yeah, it's still with us today, Joe.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And again, as Peter Feeney, one of the first things he said was remember the 25 children. One of them was 3, and that was to be later on, obviously, Patrick Carl Gibbons, your husband.
That's it. So Pat is still talked about in our house as granddad. You know, trying to explain to our kids, so it would be his grandkids, about what happened with them. That would be a tragedy. And, you know, I've obviously spoke to people over the years, past family. He had 8 brothers and sisters, I think it was. And, you know, everybody always spoke so fondly of him.
Yeah.
Real entrepreneur, great, great guy. And, yeah, so, but I'm the other end, so I don't remember when it actually happened.
Yeah, of course. Okay, Cathy, well, God rest him. And again, that's a reminder of how young he would have been how young Pat Gibbons would have been. He had a 3-year-old child.
Yeah, no, he was an older man having a 3-year-old child.
Okay.
Yeah, so he wasn't young, but it was still, and probably even more of a joy to have, you know.
Yeah, of course.
At the time, yeah.
Okay, Cathy, well, condolences again to your extended family. That's Cathy Gibbons. Maura Donoghue, joe@rt.ie. You have
Hello, Joe.
People are baffled by this whole thing, a Beaujolais race. But you think you know where this... And Peter used the phrase, and he used it in a kind way, it was a nonsense race. But you remember how it started.
Well, Joe, I worked in Dobbins Wine Bistro, which was on Stephen's Lane, which was owned by the wonderful John O'Byrne, God rest his soul. Now, I started working, it would have been in the late 80s, possibly 1987. Okay. And I do recall hearing the story that the lads were going to get the wine for Dobbins Wine Bistro.
Okay.
To bring back the Beaujolais Nouveau.
Yes.
Yes. And of course, Dobbins was an institution back then. And I certainly, you know, as a very young teenager, remember, you know, all the boys from the press, from the Herald, the journalists and the photographers coming into Dobbins. And, you know, back at the time when I worked on reception, you know, I would have known all the lads and I would have called them to let them know if there were certain celebrities coming in.
Okay.
But John O'Byrne, the wonderful man that he was, he always ensured that he had something in the Sunday World every Sunday.
Yeah, of course, yeah, you had to,
He always had the boys lined up with a story and a photograph, regardless of what was going on, the first pheasants of the season or...
Yeah.
And, of course, then, you know, particularly on a Monday evening, because the restaurant didn't open on a Monday, John would organise, you know, wine tastings and... he always had the press involved and, you know, wonderful, wonderful stories and such a wonderful institution that it was.
Yeah.
But as I say, that was my recollection of, and that's what I was told as a very young teenager when I went to work in Dobbins, that the boys were going to bring the wine back to be sold in Dobbins.
And remember, again, you're touching on it more, the social scene. The world we lived in the 80s was totally... Dobbins was an institution. It's behind where the Merry Hotel is now. Because there wasn't many well-known restaurants.
You know, and even back then, you know, we always had an annual evening, firstly for all the senior residents that lived in that area, and the Dubliners used to come in and play for them, you know, for the Christmas party. And then, of course, all the boys in the hotels... the boys that they the staff, you know, because they would recommend Dobbins if a customer was looking for somewhere nice to go for dinner, they would recommend Dobbins. And then we had an annual evening, we brought in all the porters with their wives as well, and again the Dubliners used to come in and play for them.
It was a very small city, and that's a very small country in those days.
Yeah, and you could count the amount of restaurants in Dublin.
That's
and,
true,
you know, we all knew each other. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time.
Yeah, that's why these names resonate so much with people who are around then, so to speak. And because the newspapers involved, the Herald especially, and there was the Evening Press, as Lee mentioned, the newspapers involved were consumed, where people would wait on the Herald and the Press every afternoon. Because there was no other, there was, anyway, I hate going on, there's no mobile phones or social media, but that was the world we lived. That's why it was such a, apart from the tragedy of 9 people, I know there was 61 killed in Tusker Rock, and we still talk about that, rightly so, but there was 9 people, there was 4 great airmen killed in Tramore, but there was 9 killed in this particular, this tragedy.
Yeah.
Okay, Maura, thanks indeed.
And just, can I just say to you, before you go, I grew up in Edwardstown in County Longford, and I was the first of 4 sisters who worked in Dobbins over the year. Myself and Kay, Roisin and Pauline. And we had a wonderful time in it.
Okay. Thanks indeed, Maura, for those memories. And that Christine Smith. Christine, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
And in another sad way, you have a connection with this disaster.
I, 40 years ago, my husband should have been on that flight.
My God.
And on Halloween, I had come home with our third son. I gave birth on Halloween.
Right.
And I just remember hearing about the crash and going up to my husband and not letting him go and feeling for the families, particularly John Feeney's family, that his wife had been widowed with four children. God. And that could have been me. And it had a very, at the time, a very profound effect on me. And I'm still very conscious of the loss of those nine.
Yeah,
but people don't remember is the fun of the times. People refer to, you know, the social scene and the social diaries and the diarists. And John O'Byrne was such a good... I knew Maura. Maura would know me. It was just... It was just so sad the way it worked out.
And
Beaujolais was fun.
Yeah, when there wasn't much fun around. And Christine, how come your husband was due to be on the flight? What was his connection?
Because he had connections in the wine business, and he should have been on it.
And your child,
and in September,
Yeah,
he should have been on the flight. Yeah. And in about September, he changed his mind. And so did, later than that, John O'Byrne opted out as well.
Yeah. And your baby arrived then around Halloween, which had been, what, 2 or 3 weeks previously?
On Halloween, yeah. The Beaujolais race, as it was because in France, there was a law that stopped Beaujolais being moved from the vineyard until, I think, I'm open to correction on this, I think it was... The Thursday after the third Sunday in November.
Okay, typical.
And
French,
trucks couldn't even start. Yes. You couldn't get it in and be ready on the release date. You weren't allowed even import it. You could not have it in. And so the only way was this. I think the guys used to start off
at midnight
in the Shelburne.
At midnight in France, the trucks would take off from the vineyards to Paris or whatever.
Exactly.
But they couldn't leave before that. Yeah.
Yeah. But there was some connection here. There was a wine producer in Beaujolais, and he had a brother, a restaurant owner in Paris, and a few cases had been put in somebody's car, and they were in the restaurant. So the Irish crew would go over, have a meal in the restaurant, and then, you know, get back onto the plane and bring a couple of cases of the wine with them.
Yeah.
And I can remember when my middle son was born 3 years previously, also in October, I was in RTE waiting in the green room in for the Late Late Show, and Twink was ready to pick up a big bottle of Beaujolais, like a 3 litre bottle of Beaujolais, that came in by motorbike courier from the airport, and she presented it on the Late Late.
A gimmick, yes. For charity or whatever.
For charity. And it was auctioned for charity then, on the GB show on the Monday or Tuesday following.
Yeah. Innocent days, Christine. Innocent days.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And thank you so... You so movingly remembered your other families, and going back to what Peter said, the 25 children, the nine spouses and the 25 children. Thank you so much, Christine Smith. Joe at rt.ie, 51551, text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
There are more memories of that disaster 40 years ago this month. Nine people killed. Eileen De Bruin. Eileen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. You want to remember Tony Heenahan, who worked for the Evening Herald.
That's correct.
Was he their social diarist? Is that what they called it?
Well, I grew up with him, so I do know that he was a journalist, and I knew him as Anthony.
Oh, but, of course.
He was an only child, and myself and Brenda Fricker would know him very well as well. We were both in the Burke School of Drama.
Yeah.
He could have been an actor. He was absolutely outstanding. He was the funniest person that I knew as a child. Yeah. He was amazing. And even when I got into my teen years, like, I remember we were doing, I suppose I was doing Deirdre of the Sorrows and trying to be very, one would say, very stern about the whole thing. And Anthony was a court jester doing something else. And the little devil stood in the wings, and I remember it well, and he shook all the bloody bells, and it literally threw me off. And so much so that they pulled the curtain down, half my leg were outside and the other half of me was inside. He was a jester, he was a joker, he was great fun. And I remember as an only child when he died, his mother had given him a silver coin. And they found it on part of his body and one part of it was all burnt. But I had it redone, had the silver, had it all cleaned off, and I put it into a necklace for her, a silver necklace. And I gave it to Agnes, was her name. She was a nurse. And I believe even when Agnes died, she had that around her neck. She didn't live too long after his death.
Okay.
An only child, you can imagine. But all I can remember, Anthony, is I knew him for so many years as he was grateful, absolutely grateful. Okay. I believe he was an amazing journalist. I didn't know that part of him, but Brenda Fricker would know him as well as I would because we were doing drama together all those years from the age of six. But my God, I was devastated at the time.
A lot of people are. People are sending me in cuttings from newspapers. We full pages. We will not forget them. The effect. Incredible. Okay, Eileen, thanks indeed. That's Eileen De Bruin. Joy Baxter, you want to remember the pilot, Jack Walsh. Please do, Joy.
Yes, Jack was married to my first cousin. Her name was Hilary, and funny enough, she was an air hostess in Aer Lingus.
Okay.
But once she was married, of course, she had to give up her
in
job.
In those days, yeah.
Yes, they had two children, a boy and a girl. But the sad finish to the story, if you like, is that when the crash happened, Hilary was in St. Vincent's Hospital in Dublin being treated for breast cancer.
Oh, God.
She was operated on. Now, in those days, once you got breast cancer, that was more or less the end. And I suppose it was the shock of Jack being killed. She died very shortly afterwards, and the children were 13 and 10 at the time.
So young. And I hope you're telling me Hilary never recovers?
No, she didn't.
She'd be very young, so when she passed.
Yes, we were the same age. So another coincidence was. I had visited them, I think it was a few months previous, and something had come up about people dying and what happened to you when you died. And Hilary said, oh, we have a family grave. And Jack then said, I want to be cremated. Okay. I don't want to be buried in the earth and having worms eating me and that.
Of course.
And after he was killed, one of the children, he had an enormous funeral. He was buried from Killiney Church of Ireland. And one of the children said to Hilary, but Mum, Dad wanted to be cremated.
Right.
And Hilary said, well, she said, in the end, he was cremated.
Yeah,
because he was very badly burned.
Yeah, the crash. Okay, yeah. Joy, thanks indeed for remembering Jack Walsh and indeed Hilary Robinson. Clyde Davidson, you want to remember a man I mentioned earlier, the general manager of Sands Hotel who was killed in that plane crash, Francois Chelbon.
Yes, Joe, how are you doing?
Good.
At the time, we had a 17-piece big band called the Hot City Orchestra.
Okay.
And Francois was a big fan and he had us play there for, like, to the best part of 2 years. Every Sunday afternoon, we packed the place out with three gigs with a 70-piece big band and with three girl singers at the front called Girl Talk. And it was tremendous. He was a pure gentleman.
And he looked, and I presume by his name that he wasn't born in Ireland. Maybe he was he?
No, I understand. He was either Belgian or French, to the best of my knowledge. But he did live here. He had family here.
Okay, he had another again. More family, more children left without a young father. Okay, Clyde, thanks.
Lovely man. Yeah, no problem.
Well said. Thank you so much for remembering Francois. Des is in Howth. Des, you knew four of the nine people who were killed in that plane crash.
They were all very well known people.
Yes.
Joe, and the funny thing, well, it wasn't funny, of course. The tragic thing was that Ireland is such a small place that somebody should, everybody knew these four guys. They were all brilliant guys, and the surprise very much at the time also was they were very different people. And I remember at the time we were all puzzled as to why, they were all together. Because there was no surprise that John Feeney was on the trip. John was a wild card. Brilliant guy, great guy to deal with. But Kevin was quite serious, more so than Niall Hanley. Niall Hanley was a great journalist, but he was a hard-nosed journalist.
Yeah, he was the editor of the Evening
Herald. And he was a tough guy. He was a tough guy to get a story with. Yeah. Tony Hennigan, the other thing was, Tony was I always regarded Tony as being very quiet compared to the others. And I think there was a story at the time that Tony was a nervous flyer and didn't really want to go.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure about that, but he was persuaded at the end of the day. If I remember rightly, Tony was son of Tom Hennigan, who was a legend in the newspaper industry well before them. And by a strange coincidence, Francois lived down the road, about 200-300 yards away from me. So, that was five of them. Yeah. So very, very, very tragic at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the other thing about it was such a silly trip.
As Peter said, it was of its time, this meaningless, these races that took place.
But Joe, you bring back memories, and so far as you mentioned, I think about five crashes.
I'm very conscious of saying to people, I know we're talking about a plane crash, but as I heard elsewhere today, your chances of being killed in a plane crash, you've a better chance of winning the lotto jackpot, not a lotto prize, the lotto jackpot. It's so rare, thankfully it's so rare.
And it's so rare, Joe. But I was going to say that of the five crashes, I knew four people I knew a person in each of those crashes.
Yeah.
Every one of them. Okay. I mean, that's how small a country
small
we are.
Country was, yeah. And remember, again in the '80s, air travel was still exotic. Beaujolais wine was exotic.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and if I remember rightly, John in Dobbins, John O'Byrne, I think the wine was going back to Dobbins, and John was a great character as well, amazing character, and John was due to go on that trip, if I remember rightly, and for some reason or other, he was so lucky that he pulled out of it. Very, very sad.
And finally to Peter. Peter, is there a memorial to the nine people anywhere? Are their names together anywhere?
I don't think so. Not that I'm aware of. Obviously, they have their own headstones where they're buried. But I don't think there is any memorial I'm aware of.
Yeah. Okay, well, as you can hear now, a lot of people remember. Because
can I make one final point, George, if you wouldn't mind?
Peter, yes.
One of your contributors there said that John left four children behind. In fact, he had five children.
Okay.
My nephew's five, ages from about 10 to 1. So it was very tragic for them, obviously. And obviously for all the other children as well.
And thanks for reminding us of that right at the outset. That's Peter Feeney. Talking of children, on the day that's in it, some good news. Just broken in the Irish Independent, Keane O'Brien, Social Democrats leader Holly Cairns and her partner Barry have welcomed a baby girl on the same day that the country goes to the polls. So congratulations to everybody. Holly Cairns and Barry have had a baby girl on November 29, 2024. What a historic day.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, we start talking about, we mentioned, I think it's 10 days ago, I saw an article which said Letterkenny and Derry Veritas were shutting down. And then we discovered that all the Veritas shops in Ireland were shutting down and would be gone by the end of December. And then we contacted loads of different threads, papal blessings and calls and various, because Veritas primarily dealt with religious books and artefacts. Christina Farrell. Christina, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
You worked for Veritas doing what?
Oh, yeah. Over the years, I was called in to do some illustrations.
Okay.
And there was one actually TV show that they were putting on. It was about, they were trying to bring in sex education into schools.
Okay.
And it was kind of a very tricky area, but the illustrations would be sent back if there was anything untoward in them.
Okay.
But there wasn't, but I mean, I have nothing bad to say about.
Okay.
Well,
Christina, we heard this bizarre episode yesterday where Archbishop Kevin McNamara of Dublin, he's a moral theologian, he would, accompanied or driven by his chauffeur, go into Abbey Street in Dublin, and luckily some of the staff got the billy, someone was keeping hello and ran in ahead of them and said, quick, the Archbishop is coming. And the staff would remove books like The Joy of Love, which was only drawings, remember, Christine. There was nothing, nothing you wouldn't see on the front.
I probably did some of them. But look, listen, they did their best at the time.
So my point is the Archbishop would go around and say, get that book off the shelf. Get that book. Take that down.
Yeah.
What about your... Were your illustrations ever vetted?
Well, you never knew what was going on. Like, I did an illustration. This is an example of one of two little angels standing on a hot water bottle.
Okay.
With a cloud, you know, and they were just barely touching each other. And the tummies, they're two little girl angels. And I was asked to redo them and make them apart. Just get an eraser out and put that they weren't touching on the tummies. But they were also nervous. I mean, I actually did a course with six teachers in a room in the school that was vetted by the Department of Education.
Okay.
But we had these big red folders and we were told not to show them to anybody, and we were walking around and, you know, it was all as if there was something really bad. You know what I mean? But it was never, like when I was a kid in school, we had, I was just telling the girl, we had a library in the room. It was a cofre, a press.
Yeah, of course.
And the Bundy and Judy were in it.
Right.
And on Friday when it was library time, there was a mad rush for the Bundy and Judy.
Right.
Because every frame of the ballet dancers was covered with scotch tape, a triangle.
Stop.
Like a skirt.
By who?
By the nuns. Like, say a ballet dancer and she was
the
doing
Bundy
a kind
and
of
the Judy were censored.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there was a coloured tape or whatever put over...
Scotch tape, tartan tape, like a triangle skirt. But they never took into account that the leg would be sticking out the side of the skirt. So we thought there was something terrible under there, and we spent the time trying to peel up the tape to see what it was.
Mother of good grace. Good grace.
But they did their best for the time. So they were afraid too, I suppose, you know. I also did the illustrations for Kairos magazine.
Oh, yeah, they're a good magazine,
Yeah, they were good. And he was just do anything you like. The priest, Michael Melvin was his name.
I remember Michael Melvin, great padre.
He did prayer at bedtime and the Angelus. But he was really advanced. I mean, he bought two outside broadcasters to combat what was going out, that he said there was no point in giving out unless you showed the other side.
Yourself,
he was brilliant. Yeah. He was actually brilliant. And so were the nuns. And, most of them.
Yeah.
But I work for the Clooney nuns, and they're so open-minded. And I'm always trying to get a plug in. They're in 13 convents in Haiti, a godforsaken country. Mm-hmm. And they're in bits now again
As you say, in a godforsaken country, that's where the nuns would want to be, isn't it? In that sense, that's where they see their mission.
Well, we made about 3 million for them on the radio. And I know you're not going to say it's not to say, but Dennis O'Brien gave us list over. Yeah,
he was excellent and helping Haiti as well. Okay, Christina, I'm going to go to Anne, and you might remember Anne. Stay there, Christina. Anne O'Brien worked in Veritas.
Hello.
And from what age did you start?
No, I only worked there for summers when I was a child. But my dad, Michael Dalton, worked there from when he was 13,
Wow.
He was there from when he was 13. He started as a messenger boy and a postman.
But Anne, do you mean full-time working?
He worked full-time there, yeah, up until he retired.
From 13, okay. So how many years? You're talking 50, 60 years?
Yeah, yeah. Until retirement age, he retired from Veritas.
And what did he, what was it? Well, he loved it, obviously, or he liked it, to say the least.
He did, yeah, he did. And what I was telling your researcher yesterday was that all of us had a twist of working in Veritas at some stage, and there were nine of us.
Okay. Nine of you got a job there.
Yes, yes. Like we did work experience or summer work or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But at the time was appropriate. And my brother Martin, who was mentioned yesterday, he's worked there since he left school, and he'll be finishing up soon now when they close up. So he's been all his life there. My other brother Paddy is still there as well. They're in the warehouse out near Blanchardstown.
Okay.
But Paddy's granddaughter, who's another generation, works in the shop in Abbey Street part-time. And since my dad started in 1942, there's always been a Dalton in Veritas.
Well, the tradition is going to finish soon, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. Sad.
Okay, Anne, and I just think it doesn't happen anymore. People go to work at 13, 14, and they work in the same place till they retire.
Wow. He worked his way up, you know. He started.
And
Anne,
briefly, were there any perks? Like, did you get free books or free rosary beads or free papal blessings?
No, we didn't. Okay. Not at all. No, you had to buy everything.
Okay, Anne. Thanks indeed, Anne O'Brien. Okay. Remembering Veritas. Joe at rt.ie 51551.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at rt.ie. Darren Hanley, again, the name is a clue because I'm thinking one of the nine victims of that air disaster was Niall Hanley. You related to him, Darren?
Yeah, Niall was my uncle. Hearing the program today, just hearing the memory of all of these great people that were like rock stars to me when I was younger. And
they were household names in Ireland. And
yeah, they were household names, but they also kind of, for me, they kind of inhabited a part of, you know, that part of journalism, which is not the same today.
It was exotic and there was a glamour to it. Yeah.
And certainly passion. So much passion for the work they did and the stories they told. Yeah. So incredibly important. Anyway, I just wanted to kind of...
Would you remember it, Darren? Would you remember? Because you would have been Niall's nephew.
Yeah, well, obviously. I mean, there are very, very exact memories of that time.
40 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, but it was kind of... I remember my dad waking me up in the middle of the night to you know, in an emotional state, you know, just stating that Niall had died and how that carried on in the days that followed, you know, the emotion, the shock for everybody, in the family.
Yeah. And your dad and your mom.
And my dad, for his brother. My dad is the last of the family, the baby of the family. It was a shock. I have memories of the newsroom in the Herald, office, Niall's office as well. And it being absolutely electric. I mean, it was a very potent energy. You know?
Like something. And people, again, if people saw all the president's men, it was a smaller version of that newsroom, but it was noisy and clickety-clackety and wires everywhere.
They probably had about the same square footage. There was as much going on.
Exactly.
But, some great characters and certainly their memory still living on.
And as you can hear from our calls today, much more than I expected, people remembering it and remembering that time. But as I said, when I start going through various, and it's no way to do them, but it was one of the worst air disasters ever to affect this country.
I was just a kind of, you know, apart from the fact that, you know, the circumstances are tragic, you know, it's just the loss of, you know, people who are, you know, a part of people's daily lives, reading their columns, and just, and just, you know, people, family, people that aren't with us anymore. But anyway, just a big tribute to them.
And I say, where are you now, Darren?
I live outside Paris.
Okay.
And we have the reminder every year.
It's a certain day in this month, obviously. And is it still marked?
Certainly, yes.
Is it? Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't anything that was exclusive to Ireland. The Beaujolais race was, you know, obviously restaurateurs bringing back wine. And the first cases of Beaujolais, be it England, be it Ireland.
Now you're putting a context on it.
And I could only imagine the energy and the vibe that they had going on a junket like that, you know, just to say, oh, come on, we're going to get some booze.
But I didn't know, it was a phenomenon across different countries, which restaurant would be the first to get the bottle of Beaujolais when it was released at midnight from the vineyards, driven to Paris or whatever, and then you got it out to the airport and you race back to your home country.
Wow. Yeah, kind of a cannonball run.
Well remember, and great. Thanks for putting that in context again to remind people of the nature of it and the world that was around. Thanks indeed, Darren Handley. Patrick Chambers, you want to remember Pat Gibbons, your nephew.
Yes, Joe, thanks very much for having me on. When I heard you on the programme this afternoon, it came back to me as clearly as ever. I have a poignant memory, especially of driving my mother, who was Pat's sister, to the airport and seeing the 9 coffins coming in. And in fact, my uncle Pat was the owner of the Chicago restaurant and shareholder with Sands Hotel. So that was one of the ideas, to have that Beaujolais wine available, one of the first nightclubs or restaurants in Dublin to have it. So he was always a very kind man to us all, and very generous and very lovely. And I can just remember him as clearly as ever today. And it was my sympathies really to all the other 9 people and families who've lost their loved ones as well.
And as you heard today, Patrick, a lot of people, it is 40 years ago, but a lot of people still remembering, and remembering the times as well that were in it. Okay, Patrick, thanks indeed. That was remembering the Beaujolais race. And I thought there, Darren Handley, it was a phenomenon in different countries, would be in Paris on that particular day. And as Darren said, it still is a feature. The Beaujolais 2024 was released, 10 days ago at midnight. Then you'd driven to the various cities. Then there was a race to get it to the various restaurants in Dublin, London, obviously Paris, Berlin and Vienna. And it goes on and on and on to this day. By the way, on Monday the 23rd of December, on the eve of Christmas Eve, we're going to turn our airwaves here on Liveline to Little Liveline. Doing this for a number of years now. It's great fun. We want to hear from young people of all ages, well, under 16, with stories about their... You want to review your favourite book, your favourite film, your favourite toy, your favourite hero, your favourite teacher, your favourite school, your favourite subject. So if you are listening, or indeed parents or adults are listening, or guardians, child, niece, nephew, next-door neighbour who fits the bill and wants to... have their 7 or 8 minutes of fame on Liveline, they're more than welcome. It's December 20th. Just send an email to joe@rt.ie suggesting what you want to do. Or a WhatsApp. You hear the WhatsApp number now. WhatsApp voice note 087-4848-888. 087-4848-888. And you can send a voice note. And they can send in their audition of what they want to do, a poem, a song, a ditty, or whatever. Okay, today on Sound, Liam Mullen, broadcast coordinator Shane Galvin, producer Owen McLaughlin, series producer Ned Egan, and Ray Darcy is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Refresh your home with the latest colours and designs in curtains and bedding, in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.